Dutch person, the Dr. Sulaiman. Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm happy to have the chance, in cooperation with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, to see what you and this cooperation are doing here in that country. And so I'm very honored that I have the chance to discuss with you and to present ideas to you from the perspective of a business person today with a political history. Sometimes that makes more free to talk about political issues. Sometimes it gives a deeper insight in the economic cast, also from inside or outside Europe, about that what we're doing in our economic story of the future. First of all, let me say, well, what I'm discussing today is indeed coming from a perspective of an outsider to your country. I'm very thankful to be here for the first time in my life. Bilfinger Berger is a company with 8.5 billion euro turnover and 65,000 people working for them all around the world. But not in Malaysia, or only with a very, very small footprint at the moment in Malaysia. And one of the reasons of my visit here is that we are convinced that with our core competences, which is on the field of industrial maintenance, in the field of erecting and refurbishing power plants, and organizing facility management, so to do all that kind of maintenance behind a new plant, a new house, or whatever is installed, to make sure that it will last in a good shape as much years as possible. And this is a big market, a huge market all over the world. It is kind of coordinated approach towards existing plants and houses is more or less a European idea and a sometimes US-American idea. Not very common in the developing countries of the last 25 years, because they're very often industrial plants were erected. Everybody was happy to have a new plant, and everybody was surprised afterward that it is eroding so fast. And so I'm convinced that this is a market we want to be in. We are doing that on the tradition of a very old and very well-known building and construction company. We had a chance to do a lot of projects all over the world in the past. And so we are a symbol of the conversion of a company from one core competence of building and construction to another core competence of service and maintenance today. And I mentioned that in the beginning because that also may be a bit an explanation what we are talking about markets, accessibility of markets, and the potential of cooperation inside markets when we also are talking about economic zones. We're talking about areas of common currencies, when we're talking about dependency of regions to each other in a very globalized and connected world. The thesis of today, the euro as a guarantor of stability, well, may be a bit of provocation in these days. Not only here discussing that with you, you are watching all the discussions we have inside Europe about the stability of that currency at the moment, but I would add it's also a very provoking thesis inside the European countries in these days, because after founding this common currency, now in the first very deep and serious crisis, there are of course a lot of people thinking again about the sense and the rationale behind that, and the risks which are combined with such a common currency of independent nations. So to start a discussion, and then I think it's impossible to get all of that in a short presentation. I would offer you some bullet points in the beginning of the discussion, and then I would like, together with Dr. Sulaiman, to invite you to go deeper in that topics you are mainly interested in. Perhaps number one, why is Europe trying to organize a more and more deepening common structure of this continent? There are two basic answers I think everybody should have in mind. Number one is the history of this continent is a very bloody history. The European continent is an area where individualism as a philosophic idea was created. And as you know, looking to human rights issues and a lot of other issues, these individual value of any single person, of any single entity, is very deeply grounded in the history over the last 2,000 years of that continent. And this is not only an individuality of single persons, it's also an individuality of nations, of groups of people organizing themselves with an independent culture, different languages, living in different regions, so they are very near to each other, but sometimes on mentality base, they are relatively far away from each other. And everybody should have that in mind when you are talking about what is the rationale behind bringing Europe in a situation which makes it impossible to be in war against each other. Today, this is a peaceful continent, and I am absolutely sure that not only for my generation, but also the generation of my sons, that will be the fact. But the last small war, 400 kilometers south of Munich, is 10 years ago, when we had in the former Yugoslavia all these conflicts. So we do know that nobody has the right to say that what we experienced in the first half of the last century will never happen again. Politicians and people in business and all other areas have to create structures which make it basically impossible that it will happen again. And so one of the sentences the former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl always repeats when he discussed about the common currency is you cannot pay two armies fighting against each other with the same money. So the idea of integrating Europe is an idea which is not only an economic one, it is also basically a political one. But it is always thesis and antithesis, knowing that integration is necessary and being proud of individuality. And all what you're seeing today is at the when you bottom line, it's a result of exactly these tensions between two very, very basic intentions how to create your future. But the second point why we're discussing that is economic. Economic, first of all, when the European Union and the predecessors of that were founded after the Second World War, it was a tax union, it was to have a free trade zone, it was to push economic cooperation in larger markets than the single countries in Europe can provide. This is more or less fulfilled today. This is one market without any important barriers between the countries belonging to Europe. And that is far in size than only the countries which are now integrated into Euro. So also the free trade agreement with Turkey, for example, is an open door from one to the other. And in this perspective of having trade between both parts, there are also barriers are nearly totally down. So inside Europe, we have one market, and that's important for all those who are economically concentrated to Europe. Let's take as an example my company. from this 8.5 billion euro, more or less 80% of the turnover is in Europe, 50% of that is in Germany, and 50% of that is in Europe outside Germany. For us in our daily business, that's no difference. That's Europe. We have no difficulties in transaction between entities in Europe. What is looking to tax, to labor law, to bringing goods in and out, it now is one market. And no one should underestimate the stability of currency in having one currency. And so writing off all the issues we have in our balance sheets of currency troubles when we have to provide our services or our goods to different countries with different currencies. Today, the most important idea why we try to be so strict in continuing the European process is economically, not only internal inside Europe. It is very much driven by assessing what will happen in a globalized world of the future. 1945, after the Second World War, nobody was aware of that, what can happen in globalizing economy. And I think also in 1990, when the basic treaty of the foundation of the euro was signed, most of the people were not aware of the dramatic speed of globalization. We saw in the last 15 years via communication and internet, but also with the tremendous push-up of that countries we in the past called developing countries, and you are a part of that, and you see your own track record here where you can be proud of how fast you could get accessibility to international competitive markets. So now the vision of a globalized economy has more and more to do with the issue who is representing interests in this globalized economic world. Because maybe we are all good business people, but we cannot be better than the regulatory framework we are working in. And there is always a regulatory framework in any state and in any region. The question how it fits to each other, how it is open to others, how it is enabling competition, or it is protectionism. And we are working with a lot of different philosophies in the world. In the old world, the countries which are in economic prosperity were most of them were democracies. Very few state-owned companies in that, and so a clear division between government and government interests and business interests. Today, after the communist world had accepted that the market economy had won, we have a majority of successful market economies in the world, which are no democracies by the classic criteria of that, and which are big influence of government into the daily business of companies which are owned by the governments. So the competition playing field is not flat. It's quite different all over the world. And when you are watching what the World Trade Organization had to discuss in the last years, it's obvious how difficult it is to come to common solutions to define how the playing field of the future should be designed. And I am totally convinced that 100 and 150 independent nations are unable to negotiate level playing fields because these are too many interests. So we in the future of the world, we have to found groups of interest which will be basically regional, who are able and competent to speak for a group. Some of the nations will be a group itself as one nation. The Chinese neighbors is a good example for that. India will be another one. So when you're representing 1 billion people and the market behind, we have not to discuss whether they will assemble in a group or not. But we Europeans, at the end of all the day, including all the demographic developments we have, we are some between 400 and 500 million people. And we will not become more. So, however the world of the future is organized, we will be a relatively small group around the table of others talking about the future of the economic world. And we as the Germans, 80 million people, well respected in business life, we are too small in a long-term perspective to have a seat in the first row around the table. These both issues prevent experience we had in the last century and give us a chance to be partner of the modern globalized world on eye-to-eye level with other important players around the globe, are the basic issue of the discussion. Why are we organizing such stressful process of bringing European countries nearer together? So number two of my remarks is the politicians in Europe in the late 80s and early 90s who decided to construct the European Union and the European currency zone had to decide whether they do it in the classic way as all the scientist world is presenting to them what will be right, which basically means you have to have a full scope fiscal union, a more or less full scope political union, and then the last point of the building, so the, let's say the roof of all, is a monetary unification. To think about that would have meant, and would mean today, you will not have a common currency in the next 10, 20, or 30 years. Because to bring all the independent parliaments to the decision to give up their national independence is difficult for two reasons. One is heart and head of every single individual in all these countries. And second one is that by the constitutional law of all these nations, it is difficult. Some of you may have heard that in the last weeks in the very Republic of Germany, one of the most important points of interest was a decision of the Constitutional Court about the EMS treaty, so the European Monetary Stability Fund structure, and whether it is allowed by constitutional law in Germany or not. The question mark whether it is allowed or not is how far is also Parliament allowed to transfer authority to a supranational level as it is done in this Monetary Stability Fund. The answer of the Constitutional Court is, as sometimes people in the law business do, say basically it's difficult. In this precise point it's allowed, but there are some obstacles we have to think about. And so to come to a point to say, well, it's extremely easy, let's bring all the links together, that's illusionary. Politics in Europe in that issue with respect to democratic electorate in all these independent nations and with respect to constitutions mean that that integration is a process, and this process needs generations. We achieved a lot. Please remember that French and Germans were strong enemies in a war 60 and 70 years, but not more, ago. The upcoming friendship between Poland and Germany in the Eastburg is much younger. And also till now, it's a difficult process. In the next and upcoming next generation, that is a discussion about history, and that's difficult enough. actually, it is still a discussion about own personal harmful experience, and that is sometimes unsolvable. And therefore, the question was, can everybody wait till the moment generations are far enough from own experiences to start to discuss about a deeper integration? Or looking to the global economic structures and looking to the needs to organize that in this country, it is now necessary to go the steps the other way around that a scientist world would advise us. And this was the decision to create the euro in that time. And first of all, the euro was more successful in its structure, and the European Central Bank was more respected than most people who wrote articles about that in the late 90s thought about. And when you remember what happened in the crisis in the year 2008, I think it was a very, very interesting experience for all people all over the world that the coordinated activity of the Fed in New York and the European Central Bank in Frankfurt was always the most important anchor for giving trust for the next days, which were necessary to stabilize a worldwide economic system. These both, perhaps in the future it will be three or four, but for that actual point in 2008, these both entities were able to stabilize the most crucial economic crisis of world history. Not because this crisis was so strong for a certain place, but because it was the first crisis in that strength which appears on all places of the world at the same time. We had the first time where we, for a short time, synchronized the economic cycles of the world downward. Now we have a situation where the independence between the economic cycles is increasing again, which is a big profit for the Asian region. But that was not the point in 2008. So it was a successful story in the beginning. Everybody who reads books about financial crisis and banking crisis does know that the logic consequence of a financial crisis is a sovereign debt crisis. Because financial banking crises have to be stabilized by states, because they are the lender of last resort. And this is normally overstressing the states. So basically, banking crises are crucial for sovereign debt structures. And in Europe and the United States, in addition to that, we had overstressing of the national debts before. So in addition to that situation, this is a reason for that critical status we have today on sovereign debt structures in the developed countries all over, but in Europe especially. That brought this dramatic change. That everybody was proud of the euro, everybody also in the United States was very thankful to have the European Central Bank in 2008. And then in 2010 we had a beginning discussion about what is the sense of and the rationale behind that currency, was ended after taking place in the 90s. And the same professors, sometimes the same professors, who wrote the article at that time now are back again with the message, well, that's what I ever said. And so the legitimation of this idea of a common currency again is under pressure. And this in a time of eroding confidence between markets and actors in markets. Number three of the remarks is, I think what we are talking about is more about confidence than about macroeconomic data. Let's take an example. You know, the debt financing of the state of Italy is always under pressure in these days. Italy is historically one of the G7 countries. It is a very reasonable competitor in a lot of markets all over the world. when you are counting the individual wealth of the 60 million Italians and comparing that with the individual wealth of the 80 million Germans, then the Italians are nearly 50% richer than the Germans. 6 billion individual wealth, 60 million to 4 billion individual wealth to 80 million. But the confidence in the capability of Italy at the moment to pay back debts is near to zero. There is no reason in the basic economic data of that country, but it is a consequence of eroding confidence between the actors. Can the system, for example the euro system, at the end force Italy to restructure their financial debt? And then people experienced increase that they can be involved. My personal opinion, and everything what I'm saying here is nothing more than my personal opinion, is that we politicians and business people have two issues to discuss in history about what could be right or wrong in the crisis since 2008. Number one is the decision of Hank Paulson as the Minister of Finance in the United States to let go Lehman bankrupt, because this event destroyed the confidence between banking institutions worldwide. Till now, we see every night all over the world the depositing of liquidity in central banks, which traditionally was used to be interbanking business. And looking to the figures of depositing, there is no normalization since 2008 till now. And the second issue is to force private investors to participate in the restructuring of the Greece debts. Gave up the doctrine that state debts in a country of Europe are safe. And that is not only a political wording. In our banking law in Germany, there was a clause that you have to underlay whatever you are lending to others as a bank with capital, but you have not to underlay sovereign debts. So in Germany, these sovereign debts were safe by definition in law. This is destroyed, and this today means we have no confidence about the financial structures of financing sovereign debts. No trust between banks and no trust to our states. And that is the issue we have to cope with in these days, and that will take a relatively long time to restore that in a way that we have easygoing cooperation and financing in the same way or in a similar way to that what we had in the past. Some of these kinds of refinancing structures will not appear again. So in Germany, of course, we are changing the law that you have to underlay also sovereign debts with capital. And that's right, because only that enables you for correct pricing. And it's a part of a normal market mechanism. It was a privilege for state which is not justified and was the reason for the problems we have. But that now forces us to think about the question how we can restore stability and trust as fast as possible. And this is more important for a country like Italy to come back in a normal, regular way of financing than the, as important it is, and I will come to that, the restructuring of their economic business in their own country. And without having that framework, all what you're doing in a single country will not be successful. That is the reason why now, in respect to the difficult structure of the states, the Europeans tried to install the European monetary system, which gives a part of securing the financial world around the state financing. But that is in a very pushing market situation, which we have today, obviously not enough. So it was necessary also to start acting on the central bank level. With that, what the central bank decided in the last month, to be ready to buy public debt in certain situations, to tell everybody in the market of the world to attack the euro has no chance. This is a quite normal function of a central bank. That's not unusual. It's only unusual for that central bank because it is a central bank of a currency of independent nations. To be the lender of last resort, to be with unlimited firepower, it's necessary to control the currency. But it's difficult when you hand over a part of sovereignty of a nation to a central bank which is not part of your own sovereignty. And so we had to make the difficult decision, can we, ahead of a political union and at the head of a fiscal union, now decide that we have to repair one of the mistakes in founding the European Financial Union, to say, okay, at the end of the day we need a central bank with unlimited firepower, otherwise we cannot cope with such crisis. And that we did in the last month. And that now is basically agreed also by the constitutional courts. And so I think this is one of the very important points to say that is stabilizing the euro in the framework. And now we have last point. Now we still have to concentrate on that, what is happening on a macroeconomic base, on the nations, on a continent like Europe. And that is, these are very small points in a worldwide economic discussion. But for the stability of this currency, it's more important than it seems to be. The challenge of the common currency of the future will be the question, is the balance inside the region of the common currency stable enough to have one monetary policy behind? So when a part of the continent is suffering and another part is prospering, how do you control inflation? With low interest rates to help the suffering parts, or with high interest rates to stop inflation with the overlapping prosperity? So when for a longer time the structural differences inside such a currency union are too deep, then you have extreme problems to run a common currency system. Everybody did know that when we started the European Union and the European currency system. But now we have to accept that it was obviously more difficult for politicians in the single nations to work under that knowledge in the right direction. And so being one currency offers for some countries in the south of Europe very low interest rates. And so they were not so much interested in stabilizing their state budgets, and they had to be. That is one of the reasons why we have this tremendous public debts too big in relation to the economic power of these nations. And that means you could offer to the people a better social system, better healthcare system, less hours to work or whatever. And so the competitiveness of these countries is now lower than in the beginning of the membership in the Eurozone. That's the issue in Spain, that is the issue in Portugal. Well, that's also the issue in Greece, but I don't think we should discuss all these countries. You know, the small country of Greece, it's 2% of the GDP of Europe. That's not our problem. It's a symbol for the problem, but it's not the real problem. They will need a lot of years to restructure. The other countries will have a much shorter way to go. But they have to go this way, and they have to do that with the acceptance of the majority of the population, because the governments which have to do that have to be elected. And we are now in the middle of this process, and the German Chancellor, you mentioned Angela Merkel, is in this difficult role to be the symbol of austerity in a lot of countries which are under pressure. And she is herself under pressure in her own country, Germany, not to spend too much money for those countries which she is forcing to be more in austerity line than they were before. And she has to be elected in her country next year, general election. And all those politicians she is forcing to change their policy in their countries towards more austerity have to be re-elected, otherwise you couldn't talk with them. Maybe this description is the muddling through. Maybe. But that's a part of democracy. Indeed, that is not one day, one decision, one solution. This is a step-by-step process where the important question is, are we moving towards the right direction? And are we knowing how slow the processes are fast enough in relation to the problem we have to solve? And there, I think, also there are significant steps in the right direction, but whether that will be successfully fulfilled or not will be accounted in 2 or 3 years, not in 2 or 3 weeks. And we have to have this patience because this is a democratic issue, this is a continent which has to be unified. And that is extremely harmful for markets which are quick. Markets want decisions in seconds, not in months and years. And to bring these both things together is a remaining issue of instability after the solution which I, in chapter 3, described to say what the European Central Bank and the EMS is doing now. That markets try to monitor day by day, are the Italian labor laws strict enough? Is the reduction of public spending in Spain ambitious enough? Have we new figures of employment in Portugal or not? Yes, that's all is important. But it is not possible to monitor that on a daily basis to say, okay, we are through. No, we are not through in such a short time. What I wanted to describe you is, number one, a process. I'm sure this is far away for you, but it's your dependency also to the stability of the euro in a globalized world today is stronger than I'm sure you saw 10 years ago. So we need to understand towards each other what is happening in this country. When you had asked me a year or 1.5 years before today, whether there is an absolute guarantee for the euro as a currency, I would have said yes. Would you have asked me in November and December last year, I would be more careful. Now I'm back again. I'm sure that the decisions politicians made over the last 6 months were courageous enough to make everyone in the world clear that we want to stay with the euro. And the reasons why, I tried to describe in the beginning, they are much more strategic and basic than to discuss about the ability of governments in certain parts of Europe to manage their macroeconomic issues of the year 2012 or 2013. And so my advice is for all the countries around, you should calculate with the euro as a very important currency anchor of the world of the future. You will see some turbulences around the euro in the next years, but that will not be affecting the basic stability of that currency. And this currency is helpful to organize a globalized world in a way that there are partners which can talk to each other on a high level, which gives all those who want to participate in this global world order a chance to bring in their own interests and to negotiate them successfully under a number of partners of negotiation which are so few that there is a chance to negotiate. And at so many as we have in WTO today, that it's impossible to come to a result. And in this sense, indeed, I would say the euro and the European Union are a guarantor for stability also in the future. We are in difficult times, heavy storms, but the fundament of that we are talking about is still stable. It was in danger, but my personal perception is that the important things are done, not underestimating that it will be also difficult to make all the decisions we have to do in consequence of the basic decisions we made in the next months and years in Germany and in Europe at all. And this will be a strong cooperation between people and business life and politics, because what I experienced today is that, of course, the population asks business people, why is that necessary? Is that too many risk? Do we too much pay for others or whatever? What is the sense of it? And it shows that the society at all, people who are more philosophic about Europe and the world, people who are more interested in business perspectives for single companies, and people who have to organize political structures to make decisions possible, have to work together to come over in that structure. Thank you very much, and I'm very happy to have a chance to discuss with you.